Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, and welcome to New Books and Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network of podcasts. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm the host of the show. Today, we're starting a quick series of podcasts about the mass violence in Indonesia starting in 1965. In the near future, I'll talk with Kate McGregor and Annie Pullman about their edited volume about the period, and with Jess Melvin about her book about the Indonesian army and the violence. But today, we'll start the series by talking with Jeffrey Robinson, professor of history at UCLA, about his new book, The Killing Season: A History of the Indonesian Massacres, 1965 to 1966. Jeff, welcome, and thanks for joining us on New Books and Genocide Studies.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Jeff, maybe we can start by giving you a chance to say something about how you became interested in history and interested in the history of Indonesia and how you ended up studying it from an academic perspective.
You know, it's an odd story. I have to confess, I began as a political scientist. I call myself a recovering political scientist. What I realized as I went through my various degrees in politics and political science is that what I really loved about political science was contemporary and modern history. And in fact, on my dissertation, my PhD exam, one of my examiners approached me 10 minutes before the exam and said, "You know, what you've written is not really political science. It's history." So that was a cue to me that I should perhaps change direction and go into history. But oddly, my academic path was interrupted because right after getting my PhD, I landed a job not in academia but in human rights work, working in the head office of Amnesty International in London. And that really shaped a lot of my thinking about these kinds of issues and made me much more aware of dimensions of political violence and genocide and human rights than I had been before. So it was that strange combination of being interested in political history, the experience of working for 5 or 6 years in human rights, possibly, you know, something to do with being Canadian, got in there as well, that made me interested in these subjects. The particular interest in Indonesia came quite by chance after I graduated with my BA from McGill, and I, like a lot of people at that time, I wasn't ready to do anything in particular, so I traveled, and I decided to travel to a part of the world that I didn't know anything about, and that part was Southeast Asia. I envisioned a trip of a month or two, and I ended up staying for 2 years because I found it utterly fascinating. And, of course, I was romanticizing it a little bit. I didn't really know anything about the history. But while I was there, I decided I'd like to find an excuse to come back, and the best excuse I could think of was to study it. So that really was how I ended up coming to this. And it turned out that the place that I went to study it was Cornell University, where some of the, you know, the great professors of Southeast Asia, Benedict Anderson, George Kahan, they were there, and they really guided me to think about these more these difficult questions in Indonesian history more than I think some other people might have done. So that's really the story of how I got here.
So I have to ask, so I'm intrigued by this background in political science too. How does that still shape how you think about writing about the recent past, or have you kind of not simply been recovering, but are you now recovered?
I'm not entirely sure. I find when I'm teaching about this and when I think about it, there are little bits of my political science training, a very old-fashioned political science training, which still creep in. I'm certainly not someone who embraces or knows anything about, frankly, quantitative methods or statistical methods that are or rational choice theory or things like that that are quite popular in political science these days. I would say, you know, what is there as a residual from political science is a sense that one should think comparatively. One should try to think in a kind of systematic way about why things are the way they are. And I think especially this idea that you have a responsibility to decipher what's happening, but especially figuring out why things vary in the way they do. So the variation over time and variation from place to place is a big deal, in at least as far as I'm concerned. But thinking comparatively to help to understand a place by comparing it to other places is something that I think is still kind of influences the way I do history.
So you've written about political violence, and you wrote about, in particular, violence in East Timor. Why this book now about the Indonesian massacres?
Well, actually, my interest in the massacres, the events of 65, 66 in Indonesia, dates back, you know, at least 30 years. I'm kind of afraid to admit that, but I became interested in this when I was a graduate student at Cornell, and really, again, it was Ben Anderson and George Kahan who directed me to this. I was studying with them, and in fact, it became a part of my dissertation, which was on political violence in Bali. Mm-hmm. Which the book really began and ended with the question of why had these terrible things happened on this supposedly this island, which people think of as being such a paradise. And so I began with that very kind of micro historical study of Bali. But I always had in mind, in the back of my mind, that it would really be helpful to have a much wider picture, to be able to look at the entire story, both across the Indonesian archipelago, but also to place Indonesia into a wider kind of world or regional context. And that had been pressing on me over the past 30 years. I've been gathering, going to archives whenever I could and doing interviews whenever I could. But one thing got, you know, over 30 years or so, other things kept on getting in the way. And I finally managed 4 or 5 years ago to put my shoulder to the whatever one puts one's shoulder to. But anyway, I moved back into this with a vengeance and got on with it. I think it's so. The simple answer is I've been thinking about it for an awfully long time, and I really, really just want. I felt that after all these years of thinking about other places, particularly Timor, but also thinking about Cambodia and thinking about genocides broadly, which is something I've been thinking about more and more over the years, I felt finally equipped to take on this rather daunting task of trying to understand the Indonesian violence in its entirety.
That's a really personal story. I'm thinking about this little series that I've got going, which I couldn't have done 5 years ago, at least as a genocide scholar who looks at Indonesia as a case study rather than an Indonesian scholar who looks outward. I don't know that there would have been the resources, the new books that I would have allowed me to pick up this kind of series until relatively recently. So is that right? Is this, are you in this personal way contributing to a kind of new awareness of what happened in Indonesia, or have I just not been paying attention to Amazon?
Yeah, no, I actually think this really, you've asked an important question, because one of the motivations for writing this book has been that a sense of frustration over all these years that although among a small group of Indonesia scholars, there has been discussion about this for many years. I mean, there are an awful lot of articles and so on that have been circulating among a group of 15 or 20 Indonesianists. What was striking to me and kind of frankly very frustrating and puzzling to me was that 50 years after these events took place, in which 500,000 people were killed minimally, and 1 million others were detained without charge or trial, that there still that it was still so unknown. It was a kind of an instance of mass violence was that about which very little had been written, that had entered the discussion among genocide scholars or scholars of political violence. It certainly hadn't reached the level of popular awareness. And it, to me, it really kind of called out for fuller treatment. It was just, if one thinks about it, you know, comparatively, the other kinds of genocides that we know, I mean, certainly the Holocaust, but also the Cambodian genocide, the Rwandan genocide, these are genocides which are broadly known and frequently invoked in comparative studies. There are any number of books on both and on all of these. And Indonesia, although well known among a group of Indonesian scholars, it seemed to me, was not at all and still is not well known among genocide scholars or more broadly. So part of this is just one of those things that academics do, which is to say, I wanted to address that empty space. I wanted to fill that empty space. But I also, in the book, I'm trying to answer the question, why has there been such silence?
Yeah.
Why has there been so little awareness? And so that's really, you know, one of the purposes of the book is to address that.
Well, let's turn to the book. And I'd like to ask you first to talk a little bit about, I guess you could talk about the title, but I'm particularly interested in the subtitle, History of the Indonesian Massacres. Why that rather than a history of the Indonesian genocide or whatever it might be?
Yeah, it's a fair question, and it has no simple answer, but I will say that I look at that title quite a lot and think, I wonder if that's the right title. But here's the thinking behind it. I mean, I'll be very honest about this, that my publisher said, why not call it The Indonesian Genocide, A History? And one could make a case for that. I know that other, you know, my colleague Jess Melvin has made an argument that this was indeed a genocide, and another well-known scholar, Robert Cribb, has made a similar argument. But it's by no means an open and shut case. And I suppose naively, I thought that I did not want the book to become a kind of polemic, a definitional study. I didn't want to focus my energies or the energies of reviewers on the question, is it or isn't it? Because it struck me that, you know, having looked into spent some time reading in genocide studies, that wasn't necessarily the crucial question, and that we can, I think genocide scholars often find themselves getting involved in definitional debates that may not actually elucidate important historical or analytical questions. And I wanted to focus the question on, well, what happened here? Why did it happen? What were the dynamics? What were the legacies and consequences? And why has there been such silence and inaction? And I didn't see how, I didn't want then the discussion to become, well, Robinson calls it a genocide, but perhaps he's wrong. And how does he know it's a genocide? And so my publisher said, well, can't you just throw something in about genocide and go, I may be giving away. And I said, you know, I've written the whole book kind of scrupulously avoiding that question. Maybe, you know, maybe that was, you know, a mistake. But I can't, in all honesty, you know, being intellectually honest, I can't suddenly at the very end say, because I want to call it a book about genocide, suddenly introduce an argument about its being a genocide. Even though I don't want to get into a polemic with the people who decided to call it one, because I completely understand the argument and I'm not opposed to it. It's something that, I just didn't want that to be the central the central point. I didn't want the book to be an argument about the fact that this was a genocide. I guess, I don't know if I'm making myself clear.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I think as academics, we often underrate the influence of editors in terms of how our work is perceived. I'm working now on something with Norton, and the editor with whom I started to work on this manuscript wanted me to change the title for kind of similar reasons. And then he left to go somewhere else in the company, and the next guy said, well, it's fine.
Yeah.
And that's not a particularly academic way to frame an argument, but I'm happy about it. And I think we ignore that. But many of you're right. The silence that you talk about means that many of the listeners here probably don't know a whole lot about what you wrote about. So maybe we'll start by just kind of getting some common sense of what happened. So what happened on October 1st of 1965?
Well, essentially, the story can be told fairly simply, which is that October 1st, 1965, six generals, Indonesian generals, were kidnapped and killed. And shortly thereafter, the remaining military command claimed that those generals had been kidnapped and killed in a conspiracy by the Communist Party of Indonesia, the PKI. And on the basis of that unproven allegation, began a campaign of violence against the PKI, which was a legal, popular political party, and against the left nationalist president at the time, who was not a communist, but who was sympathetic to the PKI. And in the course of the next 6 months, so from October 1965 until about March 1966, in that campaign against the left, something like 500,000 communists or alleged communists were killed. Another million or so leftists were incarcerated, some of them for more than 30 years, few of them with any trial. And so you had this massive campaign which led not only to killing but to incarceration. And there's one thing that I find very important to emphasize in this, which is that this was not a civil war. We're not talking about two sides fighting. The Communist Party was at the time completely legal. It was actually quite popular. It had 3.5 million members. It was the largest non-governing Communist Party in the world. It had probably 20 million of members of affiliated organizations, so women's groups, youth groups, farmers groups, writers groups, and so on. And these also were targeted. So the people who were being killed were not combatants. They were not people who had done anything. They hadn't committed a crime. They were farmers, day laborers, civil servants, teachers, dancers, and so on. And they were killed in pretty gruesome ways. They were, as many of them, decapitated. They were castrated. Their heads or their dismembered bodies were left in public places. And so, you know, I describe it in the book as one of the largest and swiftest instances of mass killing and incarceration in the 20th century. And I think that is still true. I think it's really important to take note of the fact that it was a campaign that was based on and that was rooted on and justified by an unproven allegation that some members of that party had kidnapped and killed six generals. And so the people who were killed could in no way have been implicated in any crime, even if that allegation had been proven true, which now for more than 50 years later, it hasn't been proven. And so making it all the more egregious, I think.
Yeah, so that's since the army and various perpetrators are going to use this as the explanation or the excuse for the violence that will come, maybe you can say a little bit more about what do we know about who planned it and why it happened, this kidnapping of the general.
It's of course one of the problems has been, and one of the preoccupations of Indonesian scholars has been, who done it. I mean, who did kidnap the generals? I think the best, there are, you know, five or six different explanations, which I'm not going to rehearse. you can look, find them in the book. But
yep.
The least plausible of the six is the official version, which has been taught in schools for 50 years, which is that it was the PKI, it was the Communist Party that did it. The more plausible explanation is the one that was... it was already suggested by the coup or the people who carried out these actions in the first place, which is that it was a group of disgruntled, somewhat disgruntled middle-ranking army officers who did not like the direction that their commanders, the high-ranking generals, were taking the country. They felt that the generals were moving too swiftly to the right, that they were perhaps conspiring with the CIA to stage their own right-wing coup, and that what they were doing was trying to preempt a CIA-backed coup. Now, could the left and the PKI in any sense have been involved in that cabal with these middle-ranking officers? Sure. There is one argument that perhaps the chairman on his own, without consulting with his standing committee or the central committee, may have had an intermediary who is communicating with those middle-ranking army officers and saying, you know, we're with you. But that is still highly speculative. And even if it were true that this fellow, Aidit, had somehow given a green light or said, you know, we're in favor of this, it is a far cry from the claim that the party as a whole and all its members and all its affiliated members were responsible for an act of treachery. So the jury is still out, except to say that the official version is the least plausible and has the least evidence to support it. The only evidence, in fact, that has been adduced to support the official version, which is that the PKI organized it and carried it out and was seeking to seize power, is evidence that was extracted under torture from the people who were detained right afterwards, and one case of a supposed confession, which could never be corroborated because the person who confessed was shot immediately after they allegedly signed it. So there's reason for real skepticism about the official version, and it's a point that I try to highlight in the book. But I guess the other thing that is worth mentioning is that, you know, even if it were true, just let's suppose, in all honesty, let's just suppose that the head of the Communist Party did give his stamp of approval to the kidnapping and killing of six generals. The question is, would that in any way have warranted or justified or rendered less outrageous the killing of 500,000 people who had nothing to do with it? And I think the answer is obviously no. But this story about the PKI's involvement was one which was very deliberately generated and disseminated and propagated through an army-controlled press in order to incite people and to encourage people to take very violent actions against all members of the left.
Yeah, so that's an interesting, excuse me, you say quite rightly, I think, that even if that were true, it would not justify the kind of mass violence. But clearly some people in Indonesia did think that it justified that kind of mass violence. So what is it? What's going on in Indonesian society in the years before 1965 that creates this kind of vulnerability to this kind of, I don't know, this kind of unusual event?
Yeah, that's very important. There's an awful lot that you could say. One very important part of this is that in the years from independence in 1949 through until 1965, so the roughly 15-year period of early independence, Indonesia is a country which has actually an extremely lively political life. There are many, many different political parties. This is not a one-party state by any means. There was a lively political tradition. There were national elections in 1955 and so on. But over time, by the late 1950s, particularly because of the Cold War context, I would say, politics in Indonesia was growing increasingly polarized between the left, a left which was dominated by the Communist Party, and the right, which was dominated by the army, which was very much involved in politics, but also their allies on the right, a very conservative branch of a nationalist party, and a number of Muslim parties, Indonesia being about 85% Muslim. And this split, this polarization between the left and the right, with the army being largely on the right, became increasingly fraught, and politics was happening more and more, I would say, in the street. So there were demonstrations and counter-demonstrations and huge rallies in which the different parties were mobilizing thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of their supporters to indicate their relative political strength and to get the ear of the president, President Sukarno. And so there was this kind of heightened political mobilization that was taking place in which, you know, the conflict, the tension was really close to the surface. But I would emphasize that even with that tension and that conflict and the kind of hyper-mobilization of youth groups and so on, there was very little violence. There were a few instances, of course, but there was not widespread violence. And so this, one has to then say, well, okay, yes, there was tension. Yes, there were conflicts. And these conflicts were not merely political. They had sometimes cultural, sometimes religious, sometimes economic dimensions, class dimensions, and so on. Fights over land, for example. But one still has to explain how such conflicts, bitter though they may be and deep-rooted as they might be, how they turn into widespread violence. And here, I guess what I'm arguing in the book is that one has to, those conflicts undoubtedly are part of the story, but they don't explain the move to massive violence. The move to widespread violence really can only be accounted for, and it's at least an argument I try to present, through the intervention of the army, which mobilizes, quite deliberately mobilizes on the basis of those pre-existing conflicts and encourages and provokes and facilitates violence on a wide scale.
And one of the ways you try and address this central claim of the book is by talking about the geographic and very personal way patterns in which the people who are killed are killed. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that. Who was killed and how were they killed?
Yeah. This is an interesting thing, which I think one can only start to think about when looking at the whole country. Mm-hmm. A lot of what we know about the Indonesian killings has been based on regional or local studies, and those have been extremely important in building up a picture. But what's fascinating is that when one puts them all together, certain patterns emerge, which were not evident on the basis of looking at one place or another. And so there's two kinds of patterns which are distinctive. First of all, the violence doesn't happen to nearly the same degree everywhere. There are some regions where there is terrible and intense violence. These are places that may not be well known to people, except, for example, Bali was one of the centers of the worst violence. Central and East Java also were centers of violence. There were others as well. By contrast, there are parts of Indonesia where there was relatively little killing. And so one has to ask, well, what accounts for this geographical variation? This is one of the things that I tried to explain. But the other thing, which is quite notable, is that even though the killing is geographically dispersed and uneven, the methods of killing, the ways in which people are killing, was actually quite consistent. And so in virtually every place, what you find is that the killing is carried out, at least ostensibly, by local paramilitaries or vigilante or militia groups. It looks as though this is local and spontaneous violence, but in fact, when one looks more closely, one finds that those militias or vigilantes are always mobilized by, encouraged by, armed and organized by the army. Another common pattern that one finds across the archipelago is the manner of killing. So the practice of bodily mutilation. Mm. Bodies are chopped up, decapitated, heads left on posts, really quite shocking things. This happens across, despite cultural differences, religious differences across the archipelago, these things are consistent. And also the use of sexual violence and the common feature of sexual violence and torture. So one has to ask, well, how do you explain the consistency in the nature and the character of the violence, but the at the same time as there's this geographical discontinuity? And my argument here is basically that the only way that this can really, the best way to explain this is by observing the role of the army in perpetrating and organizing these killings. Addressing the second question first, which is, why the consistency? What I observe is and argue is that there is a certain kind, that the army over time, really dating back to the 1940s when it was fighting for independence, developed a kind of what I call a repertoire of violence, or a culture of violence within an institutional culture within the army, such that these kinds of behaviors, certain kinds of styles of violence became commonly practiced within this institution and shared with those militia groups which served as their proxy. And so you didn't need to have an order issued or anything like that, but you had a kind of a common culture, institutional culture developing in which decapitation, sexual violence, torture, bodily mutilation, and so on were the norm. The second part of this argument about, well, why then is it so geographically dispersed? If it was the Central Army Command, why wasn't there violence everywhere? And here, what I find is that the geographical distribution depends to a considerable degree on the posture and the capacity of particular army commands. So, for example, the places where the violence was became very intense are places where the army command, the local army command, was very much in favor of and unified in its support for the campaign. This was certainly true in the case of Aceh, which Jess Melvin talks about. It was also became true in Central Java, East Java, and Bali. By contrast, what you find is where there is there are delays in the killing or there is no killing at all, it's where the local or regional army commanders are actually resistant to it. There is resistance in Bali, for example, and the killings are delayed. As long as there is resistance from the local commander, the killings don't happen. The killings are delayed for a full 2 months. And after 2 months, that commander is removed and he's replaced by someone more sympathetic to the Central Army Command's position, and then the killing begins. So this belies the claim that this is a kind of a spontaneous expression of popular anger, and underscores the point that I'm making, which is that the violence only begins when the local and regional military commanders are on board and encourage it to begin.
So that's a really thoughtful, well-considered answer. Let me pull a couple strings out of those threads. Sure. You talk about institutional culture and the nature of violence. So
yeah,
and I know you address in the book cultural or supposedly cultural explanations about violence, about the idea that Indonesians run amok and so on. Where does this institutional culture come from? Why would the army have an institutional culture that embraces and employs violence of that nature?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I you're right that I have some skepticism about sort of arguments that simply are kind of what I consider to be cultural reductionist arguments that say, oh, Indonesians, that they're so violent by nature, one can never know. This just happens. Well, and so you may ask, well, why are you making, what kind of argument is this that you're using a cultural argument to explain the behavior of the army? But I do try in the book to locate that, the roots of that culture historically. And I think there are a couple of places one can see this emerging. One is the experience of the army. The Indonesian army actually has its origins in the Japanese occupation of Indonesia during the Second World War. I'm not sure, how widely known it is that Japan occupied virtually all of Southeast Asia between late 1941 and 1945, and occupied it it was occupied by the army and by the navy, and in its time there, it mobilized local militia and other armed forces. It gave people military training in the hope that in the course of the war, those local forces would help them fight against the Allies. And so this was the formative moment for the Indonesian army. Mm. A lot of the people who later went on to become officers had their formative military training under essentially a fascist army, the Japanese occupation army. And they learned from that army certain kinds of behaviors. And these included the use of collective punishment, so burning down a village of recalcitrant or difficult villagers, the use of torture, particular techniques of torture, the brutal treatment of people who were incarcerated as prisoners of war. And so a number of these things one sees emerging almost in their exact form, almost like direct replicas in 1965 with the incarceration of prisoners, for example, massive incarceration of prisoners in what looked like Japanese POW camps, but also the use of certain kinds of torture. But it's not only the Japanese, of course, because what happens after the Japanese fall in August 1945 is that the Dutch, the colonizing power, sought to return to retake their colony. And there ensued a war of anti-colonial war, a war of independence, if you like, from 1949 to 45 to 49, rather, in which Indonesian nationalists were fighting for their independence against the Dutch. And in the course of that, the Dutch for a variety of reasons, behaved appallingly. I mean, some say it's because the Dutch had experienced such humiliation during the Second World War. Some say it's because those Dutch soldiers themselves had been in Japanese POW camps and had been brutalized and felt that they were saving Indonesia from, or that the people that they were fighting had been Japanese collaborators in some way, and they were taking it out on them. But for whatever reasons, that the Dutch forces engaged in similar kinds of misbehavior, acts of wanton violence, burning of villages, torture, public executions, and so on, which for a long time were covered up in Dutch historiography. But they are there. And regrettably, but one has to acknowledge this, on the Indonesian side, on the nationalist side, those kinds of techniques were imitated and replicated, so that Indonesian nationalists, even if one sympathized with their cause, one has to say that this was another formative moment. These 4 years of fighting were a moment when the army learned to behave in very bad ways. So that what you had after this period of occupation and then war was an army which already had developed a kind of institutional repertoire, a kind of culture, which then was compounded because over time, through the 1950s, the army grew stronger and larger and better resourced, largely because they were getting huge amounts of aid, in part from the United States, but actually a large amount of their assistance was coming from the Soviet Union. So they had more largesse. And by the late 1950s, when a lot of national industries or foreign plantations and so on were nationalized, they were placed in the hands of the army. So now they had even more largesse and more economic power and more of a stake in the economic and political status quo. These things combined helped to create an army with a particular kind of political interest, a more conservative political interest, but also with this repertoire and culture of violence that I talk about in the book.
And how
actually, you know what?
Sorry
to interrupt. There's one other thing that I should mention in this, which is that there's one aspect of the army's kind of formation in these years, which became very important in understanding the violence after 65. And that is the development of a doctrine called total people's defense, which essentially said, in order to fight our enemies, we have to mobilize in and among and with the population. It's basically a principle of guerrilla war. But this became the official doctrine of the army, and it meant that in dealing with enemies, which were, for Indonesia, frankly, mostly internal enemies in the period from the 40s through the 60s, the chosen method was always to mobilize local vigilantes or local militia forces. So there was a long tradition, already a 20-year tradition, of mobilizing these militias to carry out campaigns, counterinsurgency campaigns against perceived local enemies. And so when 1965 happens, this is nothing new to mobilize militias against the communists. This is a tried and true practice and so those militias don't have to learn that repertoire or learn that technique in an instant in 65. They've been doing that for at least 20 years.
So another thread to tug on from that original answer is another pattern. Because you mentioned mass incarceration, and you argue in the book that there is something of an inverse relationship between the number of people incarcerated and the number of people killed. So maybe you can talk about that, and along with that, and I don't want to spend too much time on the subtitle, but I am intrigued with periodization. The mass incarceration doesn't end in 1966. So what is the proper way to view this event or this period, given that people are imprisoned for a decade or even more after that?
Yeah. Oh, it's a really good question. And that's one of the reasons why, as I said earlier, I look at that title and I think, is that really the right title? Because, of course, one of the things that I think is very important in understanding this history is that it's not just about killing. Mm-hmm. It is about mass incarceration, and it's about the relationship between those two things. These are part of a single campaign. But what's fascinating too, if one looks at the large picture, I said earlier that the killing is dispersed and it's uneven. The same is true of the pattern of mass incarceration. And as you suggested in your question, what I think we can see, although, you know, more research definitely would be warranted on this, is that we're in the areas with the highest and most intense killing, the long-term incarceration tends to be lower. Whereas in places where there is relatively little killing, you see higher rates of mass incarceration, a long-term mass incarceration. And what I think is happening here, and I think there's some evidence to support this presented in the book, is that essentially, regional and local army commanders are making decisions about their preferred approach to dealing with the left, dealing with the PKI. In some cases, they choose to kill them. In other cases, they find it more acceptable, maybe more effective to incarcerate them. And so if you have large levels of mass incarceration, that's because that commander has decided, you know what, we're not going to kill them, we're going to incarcerate them. There's some interesting sort of support for this. If one looks at the areas where there was intense killing, so East Java, Central Java, also North Sumatra and Aceh, the documents that such as we have, the testimonies, the accounts that have kind of made their way through to us from that time indicate that quite often the commanders are saying, well, we simply don't have the resources, the food, or the space to have tens or hundreds of thousands of people locked up in our jails. We can't do it. We don't have enough money. So what happens is they would put them on trucks and send them out to a village and tell the local militia, deal with these guys. So killing is a way to solve the problem of over-incarceration. So there is a serious kind of logistical issue at stake that is kind of chilling, that you kill people in order not to have to pay for their incarceration, or because you simply don't have the resources and the central command has said, look, we don't care what you do, just get rid of them. And there are whole parts of the country where we really don't know still what happened. And it would be fascinating to see if somebody, you know, would pursue this and see if it turns out to be true. But that is my sense of what's going on. And then in answer to the second part of your question about the periodization, well, you're absolutely right. I mean, there were people who were incarcerated. Some people were, were detained for maybe several months or a year and then released. Some were detained for a few months and then killed. But if we talk about long-term incarceration, I'm really talking about people who are detained for several years without charge or trial. Some of them, you know, more than a decade. Some of them for 30 or more years. And a number of those were sent to basically to work camps that were, as I mentioned earlier, similar to Japanese POW camps in very remote islands. One very well-known one called Buru Island, where about 10,000 people languished for around 10 years. Why does the subtitle refer to 1965-66? I suppose there are two reasons. One is that among scholars of Indonesia and among Indonesians themselves. The tagline, the years that matter, the years that identify what it is you're talking about is really 65, 66. These were the years when the thing was set in motion, and certainly it's when most of the killings occurred. The long-term incarceration, I suppose, the second reason is that one could think of the incarceration as kind of the aftermath or the legacy of that initial campaign. That this is the consequence of that campaign of violence that had reached its effective conclusion by the middle of 1966. The army had taken over. They had succeeded in overthrowing Sukarno, destroying the left, destroying the PKI. And after 66, it was simply a question of consolidation and maintaining and developing army and the power of the army and the power of more conservative elements. So it's not, it's not a completely adequate answer. I realize, but I do wonder about it myself. But I think it put into a corner that is the best that I can come up with.
Sure.
That really the pivotal years were 65-66, and certainly one could say that the legacies of 65-66 are with Indonesia today, 50 plus years later. So
yeah, and I'm going to ask you about that in just a minute. But first, you made, it wasn't a toss-off comment, but it was a brief comment about supplies from America. That's actually a big part of your book. So maybe you could talk just a little bit about the role of foreign countries. I guess for simplicity, the U.S. and Britain, and maybe probably a brief comment about China, but wherever you want to go, how do foreign countries respond to this?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's two parts of this. I think it's helpful to think of what foreign countries, how foreign powers contributed to the situation and to the violence in the run-up to 65, and then what happened after the coup, the alleged coup of October 1st, 65. So there's the before and after. And just think very briefly, I mean, in the period before 65, I think that the simplest way to put this is that most of the Western world, but primarily the United States and Great Britain, were working, doing whatever they could to undermine Sukarno and get rid of him. There were assassination attempts. There were there was a covert operation, a very well-funded one, to support military rebels with in the late 1950s. So the CIA actually ran bombing runs on behalf of these military rebels. And provided guns and money and so on. There were repeated efforts, psychological warfare efforts. There was money that was given to anti-communist elements. There were secret meetings with people in the army, the CIA and the army. There were reassurances given that they should, if they decided to move against Sukarno, that then the U.S. and the U.K. would be all right with it. So broadly speaking, what you have is a situation in which Western powers are extremely concerned about the growing strength of the left in Indonesia, especially the PKI, and they are doing their level best to prevent that. And one of the strategies that they settle on is to try to create a situation through Psy War and all these other methods, to create a situation in which it will appear appropriate for the army to seize power. And one of the ways that they do this, they talk about in the documents, is to say, well, maybe if we can provoke the PKI into doing something crazy, like a premature coup, which fails, then the army will have a pretext to go against them. And of course, that's exactly what happened. Now, I don't know, if that's because I don't argue that that's because that it happened that way because the CIA planned it. I think actually, you know, it's unlikely that the CIA was clever enough to pull this all off. But it's certainly true that the CIA and MI6, the British intelligence agency, were doing everything they could to encourage the army and to provoke a situation in which there would be a showdown that the army would win. Because the army had the guns and the PKI didn't. So that's before 65. There is also, of course, the evidence, there's the simple fact that the United States was supporting the Indonesian army, that even as relations with Sukarno were souring, I mean, they were reaching a very, very low point. Sukarno was very anti-American and very anti-imperialist. He was very critical of the U.S. position in Vietnam, which was happening simultaneously with these developments. All as that was going on, the one thing that was consistently being done was the United States was maintaining its good relations with the army. They said, Sukarno hates us. You know, our relations are really just at rock bottom. But the one thing we have to do is to keep our relations with the army leadership. That is our only hope. And particularly, they were keeping close ties with the anti-communist element.
So even as tensions between Indonesia and China and the United States continued to accelerate, the U.S. continued to maintain and forge deeper ties with the army. What happens after the supposed coup attempt and the initiation of the mass violence?
Well, here the evidence is even stronger of U.S. and British complicity, and I use that word, you know, quite deliberately. The evidence shows pretty clearly, I would say unequivocally, that in the weeks and months following the coup, the alleged coup, the U.S. and the British and others as well actively encouraged and facilitated the violence, and they did that in a couple of ways. They began within 4 or 5 days, they had established a covert campaign of disinformation and propaganda that was designed explicitly to, in their words, blacken the name of the PKI. So they were deliberately spreading stories about how the PKI was responsible for the killing of the generals and inciting people to repeating the stories that blackened the name of the PKI and Sukarno. And this was disinformation that was being spread not only through Indonesia, but more importantly, in the region and around the world. So they're creating a kind of a world awareness or justification for the action against the PKI. The other thing that they did was they were providing covertly all kinds of assistance, economic assistance, logistical assistance in the form of two-way radios, communications, and so on, and also military assistance to the army leadership. And they did those things covertly because they knew that it would look bad for the army, which was still very nationalistic in its orientation, to appear to be the handmaiden of the Americans or the British. So there was They knew very well that they had to do those things covertly, but they continued to do them even as they got their own reporting. The cables back from Jakarta and Surabaya made abundantly clear that they knew that tens of thousands of people were being killed. In fact, I would even say that they were showed an increasing willingness to disperse this aid as the killing advanced. In other words, the army was being rewarded for its determination and its conviction to crush communism with additional aid. And the third thing they did, which I think is, you know, maybe somewhat overlooked in the way we study these things, was that they adopted a policy of deliberate silence. So they knew that there was widespread army-instigated killing and violence against civilians. But they adopted a position of silence. And this was later reflected on in Department of State and CIA documents saying, yeah, it was a very good policy to remain silent. particularly in light of the fact that so many people were being killed, that turned out to be a really good thing. Of course, when you're silent in the face of widespread killing, you are complicit in it. And so these kinds of gestures really provided vital assurances to Suharto, and that is the general in charge, and all those who were working with him, that they could move against the PKI without any kind of political or other repercussions. And so I would argue really buttressed and encouraged and facilitated the army's campaign against the left at a really vital juncture.
There's also been some talk in some strands of the literature about the involvement of China. Is there anything to that? What can you say about China briefly?
Interestingly, I would just begin by saying that the evidence that China and Mao were somehow responsible for the killing of the generals or had conspired with the PKI to try to overthrow the government or whatever, the evidence is simply not there. The reason we talk about this is in part because this was a story that was put about by the army in October of 1965, and which was repeated quite commonly by the United States and the UK in their disinformation campaign. It was listed as one of the ways to blacken the name of the PKI and to strengthen the campaign against it, because at the time there was this idea that very sort of patriotic and nationalist idea that we didn't want communist China meddling in our affairs. So what better way to blacken the name of the PKI than make them appear to be the handmaiden or the proxies of China? But as I say, the evidence to support it is really very, it is basically non-existent. And interestingly, even the internal documents, the U.S. internal documents, acknowledge that there's no evidence that at the time that China was the mastermind behind the PKI. But they continue to put out this disinformation anyway because it has a good effect, the desired effect of blackening the name of the PKI.
Well, we've taken a lot of your time, so we're coming to the end of the interview. So maybe just a quick question about how the period is remembered in Indonesia. And maybe I'll start by just saying, if my students have heard anything about this that they didn't get from me, it's because they watched one or both of the Joshua Oppenheimer documentaries, The Act of Killing, or the other one whose name is slipping my mind.
The Look of Silence.
Yes, thank you. So how are those received in Indonesia?
Well, that's very interesting. They both films have been quite well received by people of a critical mindset, by younger people, by people who are engaged with and interested in political history. Younger kind of activist groups have really been, on the one hand, quite amazed that to see these things, and inspired by them. At the same time, they have not been, needless to say, they've not been welcomed by Indonesian officials, where the reaction to and the feelings about 1965 are still really have not changed substantially in 50 years. Among military veterans, among people in positions of authority, among certain kinds of anti-communist groups, and so on, there is a deep hostility, and I mean very deep hostility, to any attempt to reconsider or revisit these events, or to cast them in to view them in a light other than the one that has been presented officially for more than 50 years. And so you have going on now in Indonesia the possibility of a real contest over history. With, you know, as I say, officialdom and military figures and some anti-communist organizations resisting every conceivable sign of a reconsideration of this history. But kind of inevitably, because of the internet, because of films like Oppenheimer's, because just simply because there more and more is becoming known, there's a kind of a bubbling up from below of not just academics doing this. I would say the academics, in a way, are the least important part of the story. But it's people who are talking to their grandmother. It's teachers in school who just can't stand teaching what they know to be a false history to their students. It's people who are wondering, when, whatever happened to Granddad? It's people who, one of whom I quote in the book, who finally got their kids through school, and they're married off, and they finally pause and think, well, you know, now that I've taken care of all of that, now it's safe for me. Now it's the time for me to tell people what really happened. So there is, this is, it is coming up from below. People are writing, ordinary people are writing memoirs of their own particular experience. They may be only published in 100 copies and distributed in a book cart on the side of the street in a small town in Central Java, but it's happening. And so this contest over history, I try to describe a little bit in the book. But, you know, I don't want to sound overly optimistic, because the truth is that there is still a deep reluctance on the part, not just of officialdom, but in society at large. There are also people who, either because they or their families are complicit, or because they belong to organizations that were complicit, or because, frankly, they just believed all that they've learned over three generations, find it very, very uncomfortable to revisit this stuff. And so it's not by any means a done deal. In that context, the films by Oppenheimer have been really important. But I'm also encouraged by the fact that Indonesians themselves have begun to make films, have begun to sing songs, and to produce, various kinds of new kinds of using various technologies, revisiting these issues. And so, you know, there are poetry slams and online people who are taking propaganda films from the past, the official propaganda films about these events, and remixing them to give them a new and more subversive meaning. There are all kinds of things happening in this genre. And one of my favorite ones, in fact, is the rediscovery of some of the songs of the left. So there was a particular song that was very popular. It actually dates back to the Japanese occupation, but it's just a very moving song about a woman who's poor and who goes out to try to gather weeds and various things to sell them in the marketplace to feed her family. It's a very haunting song, and it became popular among people on the left, and it became associated with the PKI. And after 1965, it was banned, and people who sang it were accused of being communists. And so now, in the last few years, as a kind of a way to rediscover and to reclaim that past, people now are singing that song again. And if you go onto YouTube and you type it in, you'll find all kinds of not just reposting of the old songs, but remixes of it and covers of it. You know, there are rap versions, there are electronica versions, there's everything. And so that is, it's a kind of, of course, the anti-communists are horrified because they see this as a resurgence of communism, but it's actually much more subtle than that. It's people simply wanting to reclaim their own history.
Well, we focused on your book, but you also edited a special issue of the Journal of Genocide Research. And I thought maybe I'd give you just a minute or two to talk about that and what you tried to do with that issue.
Yeah, that journal actually emerged out of a conference that was held in Amsterdam, which was a joint venture between UCLA and some institutions in the Netherlands. And the subject was 1965 today, living with the Indonesian massacres. The idea was to say, well, now we're 50 years on, what is this like? How do the events of 1965 resonate and feel to us today? And really, there were three central themes that we tried to that both the conference and the special issue were organized around. And one was this idea of competing narratives that I've just been talking about, that there's the official narrative, and then there are all these other ones bubbling up. The second one was the notion of the kind of the legacies of the violence and how they live on, even as people are competing, you know, are telling different stories. There are these institutional legacies. Institutions themselves, educational institutions, judicial institutions, political institutions, were shaped in a way. There was a kind of a reformation of the state, if you like, which lasts until today, and which is slowly, but not very fully, being clawed back and reconstructed. Even 20 years after Suharto fell and Indonesia became, you know, more democratic, these institutional legacies have been very sticky, and they've lasted even into, you know, 20 years after the switch to democracy or the reform period. And then the third main theme of that special issue is this whole question of transitional justice. What kinds of initiatives have been undertaken to try to seek remedies for these events? And here, I guess, I mean, you know, the news is, you know, both in some ways encouraging in the sense that there are these efforts to memorialize, very, very grassroots efforts to remember through these memoirs that I'm talking about, through film and poetry and so on, and music. But at the same time, the idea that the possibility of any kind of judicial process, of any kind of judicial accountability through either a truth commission or a tribunal, these seem as remote as they ever have. So you have, you know, in some ways very, very positive signs, but in other ways, a recognition that the state, the Indonesian government, is farther away than most governments would be in this. Let me rephrase that. That the Indonesian authorities are not remotely interested in pursuing any legal remedy. And this is quite remarkable when you think about it. You know, you think of other cases of genocide, Cambodia, Rwanda, the Holocaust, and so on. You know, in many of these cases, certainly the situation doesn't become perfect afterwards, but some kind of justice is eventually pursued. Indonesia is now more than 50 years, and the prospects for any kind of rendering of justice are just quite remote. And I think they argue the reason for that is fairly obvious, and I at least I argue it in the book. Going back to the book, is that you know, the people who are responsible for these crimes remained in power. And so when those responsible for the crime of genocide, if that was what it was, remain in power, the prospects for any kind of judicial reckoning are pretty remote. And they're even more remote when the most powerful countries in the world were complicit in that violence. So, and this is what distinguishes Indonesia, I think, from a lot of other cases where the perpetrators were drummed out of power and where it was their opponents who then took the initiative to seek justice.
Well, it's a wonderful book, and it's a much richer book than we've had a chance to talk about here. And so for the listeners, I highly encourage you to go out and look at it and read it, buy it. It's a 30-year project for Jeff. He ought to get some reward for it. But so to kind of conclude, I always conclude with the same questions. And Jeff, we're taping this the weekend or the Friday before Memorial Day, and so I have a long weekend available to me where it's supposed to be 96 degrees, and so I'll want to spend it inside reading or watching. What should I read this weekend? What did you find meaningful to you in the process of this project that other people should read?
You know, I'll tell you, there are, I mean, if I'm allowed to say, you know, expand the meaning of
sure.
read,
yeah.
But to start with, I would listen to that song that I mentioned.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And that song is, you know, 2 minutes long. Go onto YouTube. It's called Genjer Genjer, which is, you know, G-E-N-J-E-R, and then repeated. And the person to listen to is a wonderful woman named Lilis Suryani. There are various versions, but that's one of the original ones from the early 1960s. And I have to say that, you know, sometimes when I was writing this book and I was thinking, oh, what am I doing this for? You know, this is crazy. Too many footnotes. I would just click on Genjer Genjer and I would have my answer.
Mm.
It's a lovely song. And quite meaningful. So, and it takes you back. So, yeah, and the other thing that I would say is, you know, you referred to the Oppenheimer films. I would actually, you know, I particularly like the second film, The Look of Silence, because I find it more sensitive and really calmly exploring what it meant for a family to have experienced these things, and an exploration by a member of that family, not only to think about what it meant to them, but to ask in the gentlest but strongest way of the people who were responsible for the violence what they thought they were doing and how they feel about it. It's a very, in some ways, shocking film, of course, but it's also very gentle and I think quite moving. And the third thing that I would do, and this is finally coming around to reading, is there's a wonderful memoir by one of Indonesia's most famous writers, also controversial because he was a leftist, who spent 10 years on the prison island of Buru. And his name is Pramudya Anantatur. And he has written many, many novels over the years. He's dead now. He wrote novels and short stories. But his memoir of his time in prison is really, really something. And luckily, it's translated into English. It's Pramudya Anantatur, A Mute's Soliloquy. I would strongly recommend that. All of those three.
Well, that may take me more than a weekend, but I will put them all on my list. So thank you so much. You've spent 30 years on this. What's your next project?
You know, I have two. I swore that I told my daughter when I sent the book off, I said, no more books. And she said,
oh, dangerous.
Yeah. And she said, yeah, until the next one. And as it happened, about a week later, I had a new idea. So then the next thing that I'm working on is actually a book of photographs. And it's a book of photographs, but with a kind of very light historical commentary beside clusters of photographs. And it's about these same events, sadly. But in the course of writing this book, I just kept on thinking, wow, that one of the reasons we don't know about this and people are not conscious of it is that there's no visual record of it. And, you know, we have visual records of the Holocaust and the Cambodian and the Rwanda genocides, but who can evoke a visual memory of this in Indonesia that's absent certainly in the wider world? So I'm working with a colleague in Singapore, and we're putting together a book of photographs and images, graffiti, and other things from the lead up to and during and then after. It's not going to be a gruesome, grotesque thing, but it will capture the sort of sense of political crisis and give you a feeling for what was going on. So that's one thing. The other thing is a little project which I'm calling the Swedish Connection, which stems from the fact that I stumbled into the Swedish archives a couple of summers ago and found there the records of a remarkable Swedish man who was the ambassador at the time these events took place, a man named Harald Edelstam. And Edelstam, it turns out, had assisted Jews and resistance fighters from Norway to escape to Sweden during the Second World War. And then in the 70s, he had assisted trade unionists and Cubans and leftists who were being rounded up in the coup after the coup against Allende. So, and he happened to be in Indonesia at this time, and he wrote some, he traveled around through Indonesia at the height of the killing and wrote some extraordinary dispatches. And so his perspective on this is really pretty remarkable. So I'm going to write about him. And then the final project I have, which is probably a really bad idea, is, but I'm working together with my wife on a book which is trying to understand and place in some kind of comparative historical perspective the problem of mass killing in the United States. As I say, it's probably a bad idea, but it seems to me that this problem is one which definitely could benefit from some comparative historical perspective, and so that's what I'm hoping to do.
Well, those are all wonderful projects. Sounds like probably won't be 30 years, but it sounds like you've got the next 5 or 6 or 7 years of your life planned out. But I hope when you're done, you'll come back on the show and talk about them with me and with the audience.
Be delighted to do that.
Thank you so much for your time, and I wish you a great rest of the semester and a wonderful summer.
Thanks. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
You've been listening to an interview with Jeffrey Robinson about his new book, The Killing Season, A History of the Indonesian Massacres, 1965 to 1966, published by Princeton University Press. If you enjoyed this interview, you can listen to previous podcasts through iTunes or Stitcher or other podcast providers or from the webpage for New Books in Genocide Studies, part of the New Books Network podcast. I hope you'll join me next time when we'll continue our short series of podcasts about Indonesia. Until then, thanks for the download and have a great month.